Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Richard Hanna. He served three terms in Congress before stepping down in 2017, representing New York's 22nd District. Richard Hanna earned a reputation as a moderate Republican and a vocal critic of the political polarization in Congress. He's recently joined an initiative called Fix Politics Now, a bipartisan group of about 200 former members of Congress advocating for changes in our political system. Richard, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, let's just start with the organization. Tell me about Fix Politics Now, what it's about, how it got started, why you're a part of it.
When you're a member of Congress, one of the things you realize first is the importance of raising money and the time you spend raising money. And everybody does it. And what a requirement that is if you want to be reelected. And it's a requirement if you want to move up on certain committees and if you ever want to be a chairman. It's something I was incredibly bad at and stopped doing after the second year. But having said that, what we know is that our democracy should not be for sale. That the amount of money and the nature of the money being dark money, being with Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision, allowing interference from all sorts of places, it is denying us a true democracy where you have one man, one vote, one person, one vote. And that's why I'm a part of this, because I saw that. I think it's an absolute threat to our country. And in particular, we see that with the recent presidential election, the Russian involvement, and the issues over Facebook and Google and other media platforms.
Well, on that issue of outside money, tell me a little bit more about what you think could be done to fix that or to help that. One of the problems that I see right away is you mentioned the Citizens United Supreme Court case is that the court seems to be pretty clear, at least or has been recently, that they regard this kind of spending as speech. And so any kind of legislation or proposal that's going to run into somebody objecting to it and they're going to bring a court case, that you'll lose.
But if you read the decision, what you learn is that they said they really don't like this either. And to call a corporation a citizen equal to you or me, I don't believe they like that either. What they did say is it's a congressional problem, and it's up to Congress to solve this problem. And I agree with that. I don't agree with their decision, but I agree that now where it is, it's up to Congress to solve it. And Fix Politics Now is a part of that. They've taken on this issue and said that this dark money, these huge, incredible amounts of money, sometimes – and the problem is both sides have it. It's not as if it's a Republican Republican Party that benefits over it or the Democrats. They both do. So they're kind of loath to have that kind of nuclear disarmament, if you will. They both benefit. They don't know what to do. Nobody wants to go first. But I think if you pulled every member aside, they would all bemoan the process that exists today.
You know, when I've interviewed individual candidates and individual members over the years, the dynamic is exactly as you've described it, where individually they all will complain about
term limits. They love the idea.
That's the ocean that they swim in, and so they've got to raise the money. Now, you have always been, as I said at the outset, a very vocal critic of the political polarization, not only in Congress but across the country, that kind of political extremism that we're seeing more and more, or lack of compromise might be a better term. Is that part of Fix Politics Now's portfolio as well, or are they more focused on the money?
I think they're focused on a number of things. What you're referencing, though, is part of the result of gerrymandering. The way districts are drawn, that are drawn specifically to protect the ruling party or the incumbent in most cases. And what that has done is made the primary process, the voting in the primary process, almost the general election. You're kind of stuck with the people who are supported in the primary. And as these parties become more severe and better gerrymandered, what you notice is that pragmatic center, that people, wonderful people like Jim Walsh, Sherry Bowler, John McHugh, and Ama Houghton were a part of, is disappearing. There were about 130 or 40 swing districts where you were forced to listen to everybody, speak with everybody, and be considerate of everybody. The way it's become, that you are rewarded and sent back to Congress by pandering, if you will, to your extreme. So you see extremes in both parties, not just one or the other. And with the advent of this dark money and the ability through the internet to game people, find out what it is that you want, if it's a gun issue or any number of issues, they can target you and come into your home and make that candidate appeal to you, regardless of where they may be on a number of other issues.
You mentioned the primaries becoming, in effect, the general election in districts where there's an overwhelming majority of one party or the other. The other complication in that I've heard is that and have seen and read about is that primary elections then tend to be more driven by the most active and most loyal members of that party, who tend to be more on the edges of the positioning. And so in that sense, then the primary drives this extremism even further, correct?
When I joined the Republican Party 30 years ago or whenever it was, if you went to a committee meeting, there was a general group of people that were interested in policy and didn't necessarily come in there demanding that whoever was elected carry their flag completely. Today, there are fewer and fewer people. It's run by the extremes of both parties, and you're expected to adhere to the orthodoxy of the generally accepted policies and ideas of that party. And that's not what's healthy for this country. What was healthy for this country was having a group of people in Congress. It's so much about the numbers. There was a time not that long ago when the 100 or so swing district members could vote their conscience, vote to compromise, vote to work together, create solutions, and move forward. That doesn't exist there. And again, I can't emphasize enough how much it is about the numbers. If you look at a group like the Freedom Caucus, who votes in a block as long as they agree on 80%, I think it is, they are an enormously powerful group. And it puts somebody who's a moderate or who somebody really wants to is willing to listen and talk and work with people on both sides, bring forth the best ideas. They have an enormous advantage because the block of people, the numbers of people that I might bring together or some other member is at a disadvantage.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Richard Hanna, a former member of Congress from Central New York and a participant in the Fix Politics Now initiative. I've got a couple follow-ups about that problem you're talking about. The first is this a problem primarily, and I'm thinking of members of Congress here and other elected officials, is this a problem in the policy positions that they are taking becoming more extreme and separate, or is it a problem in the political style and in the political behavior of officials and advocates? That is, maybe the positions aren't necessarily getting further apart, but the line between them is getting starker and starker. And once the Republican Party has a position, then there's this effort, and same thing with the Democrats, to not cross that line. What is maybe that distinction is not clear.
I think it's a matter of both things. You know, and I think part of there's a caucus in Congress now. It has, I think, around 30 members that is seeking to resolve this through what's called the Honest Ads Act, where the transparency and disclosure equal integrity in the process, so that people don't just get the opportunity to use dog whistle issues, the orthodoxy of either side to attract people. People will know where their money comes from. If there's a Google ad or a Facebook ad, they will be required under this act to disclose who paid for it, where it came from. And as you know, foreign countries are not allowed to interfere in our elections. It's illegal. That doesn't mean you can stop them. But all of this is designed to address the severity of I think, and the need for individuals as members of Congress to try to kind of fall in line. And as you said, that there are very clear lines. I mean, and I cross them all the time. I was listed as, the number one rhino, which is Orwellian on a good day. It's a badge I wore happily and sadly at the same time, you know, which what it really meant
Republican
to me.
Republican in name only, yeah, right? just for our listeners who don't know
sure,
that acronym. Okay.
What a shame. You know, you go there with a basic ideas of who you are and what you stand for and what you want to do. And then all of a sudden you find out if you don't agree with everybody in the caucus, somehow you're an outsider. All of that is added to the divisiveness. But in addition to that, and I think one of the things this group is trying to do is break that apart by disallowing all this dark money and the requirements for such enormous amounts of money to run for office and the ability of money to come in from someplace you don't know and affect the outcome of an election, which we've seen. So, I mean, those are critical issues, and our future is at stake. Future democracy is at stake, as John McCain said recently. So, you know, I believe that. I have young kids, and I can't support transparency and disclosure strong enough.
Let me ask you a question about your own experience in Congress. I'm curious, you know, you had a reputation for breaking with your party, but I wonder whether there weren't one or two instances that stand out in your memory of where you were subject to this kind of pressure to push to hold the line.
You know what the biggest one was? Obamacare. How do you justify taking 2 or 3 days out of your weekday when you go on a Tuesday, you leave on a Thursday, and you legislate?
That's a problem too.
Yeah, you leave on and you legislate on a Wednesday, and then you vote 65 times to somehow change or annihilate Obamacare. It became that symbol to the base that we were working to undo something that they were told they should hate. And
so did you take some of those votes?
I did. Yeah. And I regret it. If I had it to do, and I didn't take them all, because when they would involve Planned Parenthood and other things, I would refuse to support it. But if I had it to do over again, I would say to them, if you're going to repeal and replace, I want to see the repeal. And I didn't do that. And I regret that, because I should have held their feet to the fire, because it was pretty clear after a few votes that they really didn't have a good idea of what they were going to replace it with. And if they did have an idea, it was all over the map.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Richard Hanna. Until last year, he represented New York's 22nd district in Congress. He's recently joined the Fix Politics Now initiative, focused on the problem of political polarization and money in politics. I wanted to ask you a question about your own district. I have to ask you a question about that.
Sure.
New York's 22nd. The Republican who ran a primary against you from the right, she primaried you from the right in 2014, Claudia Tenney, now holds that seat. She won the open seat that you made vacant when you decided to step down effective in January 2017. She's running now for re-election against a Democratic assemblyman, Anthony Brindisi. Assemblyman Brindisi was on our program several weeks ago, and I'm hoping to talk with Congresswoman Tenney soon. My understanding is you've publicly supported Brindisi.
That's correct.
Okay. So what do you make of how this race has developed so far in your old district, and how you think it's going to play out?
Well, my district, President Trump carried it handily, and Claudia Tenney is a person who claims to have been Trump before Trump. That's a statement of hers. And it's clear to me that she is an unmitigated, unqualified supporter of his in every way. Not an ounce of criticism has come out of her mouth over his either personal behavior or anything else, or policy behavior. So I can't support her. I'll be honest, I wish that there were a Republican that I could support, because I consider myself a fiscal conservative, and but she has supported the defunding of Planned Parenthood, has not criticized me for supporting the LGBT community and a number of other things. And so it's not a hard decision. And I think that people who get angry with me, who are supporters of her and Trump, and I certainly would love to be support Trump wherever I believe his policies are correct. But I think as legislators, you have an obligation to be a critic and a thoughtful one. And so I always chose to do that. And I still feel the same. I mean, I came out early and criticized him and said I couldn't support him. And I'd hoped that I'd been wrong, that somehow I would feel differently about that choice. I have not. I felt the same way about Ted Cruz at the time. So it's a sad thing for me, but I can't support Claudia, and I don't believe our community will. The problem I have with Claudia is that she is supported. She doesn't represent all the people at any moment. She represents the 30 or 40% that support and I assume will continue to support Trump. And the job is to find opportunities to reach out to everybody and listen to everybody and not be some extremist who has very little to offer, doesn't apparently have public meetings as often as people would like, and a number of other things. You know, she represents so much of what I find wrong with politics and government in general. And the other thing is that she's been there forever. You know, she was in the assembly and now, of course, in Congress. And I think that if there's anything I saw there that's true is term limits, as much as everybody likes to identify themselves as indispensable, they're not. And new blood, new people, new ideas, and the idea that you're not building a career in politics. And, you know, that comes back to money again, that we need to separate, break that bond between money and politics, because when you're a member of Congress, it's pretty easy to raise money. And you never feel like you raise enough, and the party never thinks you raise enough. But average folks like I was, you know, I was fortunate I funded a lot of my own campaign. But that shouldn't have been a requirement for me to run. I mean, the office was designed for people to go with a basic set of skills, you know, whether they're a lawyer or an engineer or a carpenter, whatever they were, they went, they brought their wisdom and they left someday. These people in general don't leave. And it's part of it's because it's a great job. I know that they like to say that, you know, they work hard and a lot of them do, and that they it's not a fun job, but you know, you make $174,000 a year. You get a week off a month, and if you're in a safe district, you really just tell your staff to take care of everything. And with gerrymandering, a lot of districts are extremely safe, and these guys never lose.
You know, I wanted to ask you this, prompted by something you just said about it being a great job. When Jim Walsh's father was in Congress as well, and when Jim Walsh retired, in his press conference, he told a story about his father saying, "You know, the thing I'm going to miss are those shrimp that you get
the buffets right?
that you get at the receptions." So, what do you miss? What do you miss?
I miss the ideas. I made some good friends there from in both parties. There are a lot of wonderful and bright people, and there are solutions out there that we just don't talk about. There are endless opportunities to meet in the middle and work together. But everybody that's more invested in being reelected than they are in leading and risking their career by doing that. My complaint with most members is that I miss that. But my complaint with most members is that they tell people what they want to hear. And what I think that's really not what people, of course, not what they need. And I don't think it's what you need to do to get reelected. One of the things I enjoyed was I wrote an explanation, and no one in the House or Senate that I know of did this, 974 times the day I left. I'd written why I voted that way. I felt a moral obligation to explain myself because I did have a lot of people object to my votes. And I'd say, this is what I was thinking. you know, if all you do is adhere yourself to dog whistle issues and work to get reelected and you avoid controversy, then you're not really a leader. You're kind of following your base around, which is what I think Claudia is doing and certainly President Trump is doing. And I think my experience taught me that people respect integrity more than they concern themselves with where you are. Hmm.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is former member of Congress, Richard Hanna. I want to broaden that conversation about the 22nd to thinking about the midterms more generally. President Trump's approval rating has improved in recent months. It's gone up, but it's still well below 50%. What do you see happening in November across the country?
I think the Democrats are kidding themselves if they think they can go in to this next election with the agenda that they've had up till now, which is a Bernie Sanders message of redistribution. I think one of the things that I'm very comfortable with as a Republican is the notion of accountability, personal responsibility, a society that helps everybody who needs it, but that every program has an opportunity to get off it. And I think as long as they are dealing so deeply with identity politics and become the party of we know you're being cheated, we just haven't figured out how to make it equal yet, which means coming after, you know, frankly, I've been fortunate in my life, but I'm happy to help, but I don't like the feeling that I should be guilty of being successful or feel guilty because of that.
That you're targeted.
Yeah, right. And I think that's a huge mistake. But this country loves opportunity. It loves a free enterprise system. It loves capitalism. And it loves equality and the notion that everybody can get ahead if you work and educate yourself. So instead of supporting things like pre-K, which the Republican Party, both parties should be deeply invested in, and I support it, we're ignoring those things that the world has figured out. And the world has figured out how to beat us at our own game. You know, politicians should be out there saying, yeah, the world's tough. And for the first time in a generation, or in the history of the country, rather, you may live less well than your parents. That's terrible. And that's a disappointing. And especially in upstate New York, where the median income is so low, they should be telling them, it's tough out there. You need to lift yourself by your own bootstraps. You need to be responsible for yourself. And that means getting educated, recognizing the environment you live in, and we're going to help you get there. But they're not saying that. They're looking for people to blame. And it's easy to do that. And I think both parties are guilty of that.
Do you think let's just imagine that the midterms do produce some kind of significant blue wave, and it looks like that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. Do you think if that wave is big enough, it might be a jolt to the system to help with some of these political polarization issues, or do you think it'll just get worse from there?
No, I think it'll help. And frankly, it wouldn't be a bad thing to remind the Republican Party, if they lose the majority in the House, that not everybody agrees with them, that they may win elections in their own district easily by adhering themselves to the orthodoxy of their right. But that's not America, and that's not this country. There's a reason why Senate races the Senate is more broadly representative of the country is because they're not gerrymandered, right? So I think that's a possibility. But if the Democratic Party does not come up with an agenda that I think different than the one they have, and I know Nancy Pelosi, I like Nancy as a person, but I really think it's time they have a different speaker. Everybody that I know kind of feels that way, and it's in no way meant to be an insult to her, but there are other people out there that are perfectly capable of leading that party and putting on a path that I think is more representative of the people I know in my life, in my district, who accept hardship as long as they're living in a system where they feel it's fair.
We just got a couple minutes left, but you mentioned something earlier I wanted to come back to. You were speaking about the Democrats and your concerns about the emphasis on identity politics and some of the other things in their message that they don't have that you think that they should have. You've been very critical of President Trump. You're critical here today. You were critical before when he was a candidate. I'm wondering, though, is there anything about the resistance movement that you're seeing that concerns you that you haven't already said? Tell me about how you see the resistance movement.
Well, I think those people who are going down the road of impeachment are foolish. And that's not what the public wants to hear. That just, I think, adds to the problem. I think this FBI conspiracy notion that he has is as Mr. Gowdy and Ryan have said in the last couple of days, the FBI is simply doing its job, and Mueller seems to be doing his job. And the idea that he can pardon himself is an absolute anathema to our democracy, whether he thinks the Constitution supports that or not. So I think what should be done is he is the president. We should support him when we agree with him, and we should come out against him when we don't. And both parties should do that, and it shouldn't be gang warfare or tribal.
We've only got about a minute left, but let me make sure I squeeze in two things. I'm assuming that if folks want to learn more about Fix Politics Now, they can just Google that and they'll get a website.
Issue 1 website and take a look.
Okay, great. Issue 1 website. And then just last few seconds, but aside from Fix Politics Now, what have you been up to the last year? What have you been doing?
I have two kids. I didn't get married until I was 50, and I had my first kid when I was Emerson, when I was 57, right?
I missed him for
6 years in Congress. I sucked the life out of him every day. We have a lot of fun together, and my daughter has chickens, and they're homeschooled, and my life is rich and full, and I'm happy. I think, like a lot of people, though, I don't listen to the news nearly as much as I used to. It's frankly more and more upsetting.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. That was Richard Hanna, former member of Congress. The initiative is called Fix Politics Now. Richard, good luck with that effort. And as always, thanks so much for taking the time to
talk
with me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.